Chapter 14. What a Veil Hides. The Victory of Kidron rolled on long sea swells, making the gilded lamps in the stern cabin swing on their gimbals, but Tuan sat calmly as the razor in Seleucia's sure hand slid across her scalp. Through the tall stern windows she could see other great ships crashing through the gray-green swells in sprays of white, hundreds of them, row on row, stretching to the horizon. Four times as many had been left at Tanchico. The Hriagel, those who come home, the Karen, the return, had begun. A soaring albatross seemed to be following the Kidron, an omen of victory indeed, though the bird's long wings were black instead of white. It must still mean the same thing. Omens did not change according to location. An owl calling at dawn meant death, and rain without clouds an unexpected visitor, whether in Imfaral or Noran Mishar. The morning ritual with her dresser's razor was soothing, and she needed that today. Last night she had given a command in anger. No command should be issued in anger. She felt almost Saimosief, as if she had lost honor. Her balance was disturbed, and that boded as ill for the return as a loss of Saiter, albatross or no albatross. Seleucia wiped away the last of the lather with a warm, damp cloth, then used a dry cloth, and finally powdered her smooth scalp lightly with a brush. When her dresser stepped back, Tuan rose and let her elaborately embroidered blue silk dressing gown slide to the gold and blue patterned carpet. Instantly the cool air pebbled her dark, bare skin. Four of her 10 maids rose gracefully from where they had been kneeling against the walls, clean-limbed and comely in their filmy white robes. All had been purchased for their appearance as much as their skills, and they were very skilled. They had become used to the motions of the ship during the long voyage from Shanchen, and they scurried to fetch the garments that had already been laid out atop the carved chests and bring them to Seleucia. Seleucia never allowed the Dako veil to actually dress her, not so much as stockings or slippers. When she settled a pleated gown the color of well-aged ivory over Tuan's head, the younger woman could not help comparing the two of them in the tall mirror fastened to the inner wall. Golden-haired Seleucia possessed a stately, cream-skinned beauty and cool blue eyes. Anyone might have taken her for one of the blood, and of high rank, rather than Sojin, if the left side of her head had not been shaved. A notion that would have shocked the woman to the quick, expressed aloud. The very idea of any stepping above her appointed station horrified Seleucia. Tuan knew she herself would never have such a commanding presence. Her eyes were too large and a liquid brown. When she forgot to keep a stern mask, her heart-shaped face belonged on a mischievous child. The top of her head barely came to Seleucia's eyes, and her dresser was not a tall woman. Tuan could ride with the best. She excelled at wrestling and the use of suitable weapons, but she had always had to exercise her mind to impress. She had trained that tool as hard as she had trained at every other talent combined. At least the wide woven belt of gold emphasized her waist enough that she would not be taken for a boy in a dress. Men watched when Seleucia passed by, and Tuan had overheard some murmur about her full breasts. Perhaps that had nothing to do with a commanding presence, but it would have been nice to possess a little more bosom. "The light be upon me," Seleucia murmured, sounding amused, as the Dako veil hurried back to kneel upright against the walls. "You've done that every morning since the first day your head was shaved. Do you still think after 3 years that I'll leave a patch of stubble?" Tuan realized that she had rubbed a hand across her bare scalp. "Searching for stubble," she admitted to herself ruefully. "If you did," she said with mock severity, "I would have you beaten. A repayment for all the times you used a switch on me." Placing a rope of rubies around Tuan's neck, Seleucia laughed. "If you pay me back for all that, I'll never be able to sit down again." Tuan smiled. Seleucia's mother had given her to Tuan for a cradle gift, to be her nursemaid, and more important, her shadow, a bodyguard no one knew about. The first 25 years of Seleucia's life had been training for those jobs, training in secret for the second. On Tuan's 16th naming day, when her head was first shaved, she had made the traditional gifts of her house to Seleucia, a small estate for the care she had shown, a pardon for the chastisements she had given, a sack of 100 golden thrones for each time she had needed to punish her charge. The blood assembled to watch her presented as an adult for the first time had been impressed by all those sacks of coin, more than many of them could have laid hand on themselves. She had been unruly as a child, not to mention headstrong. And the last traditional gift, the offer for Seleucia to choose where she would be appointed next. Tuan was not sure whether she or the watching crowd had been more astonished when the dignified woman turned her back on power and authority and asked instead to be Tuan's dresser, her chief maid. And her shadow still, of course, though that was not made public. She herself had been delighted. Perhaps in small doses, spread over 16 years, she said. Catching sight of herself in the mirror, she held her smile long enough to make sure there was no sting in her words, then replaced it with sternness. She certainly felt more affection for the woman who had raised her than for the mother she had seen only twice a year before becoming an adult, or the brothers and sisters she had been taught from her first steps to battle for their mother's favor. Two of them had died in those struggles so far, and three had tried to kill her. A sister and a brother had been made Daco Vale and had their names stricken from the records as firmly as if it had been discovered they could channel. Her place was far from secure even now. A single misstep could see her dead, or worse, stripped and sold on the public block. Blessings of the light, when she smiled, she still looked 16, at best. Chuckling, Seleucia turned to take the close-fitting cap of golden lace from its red lacquered stand on the dressing table. The sparse lace would expose most of her shaven scalp and mark her with the raven and roses. Perhaps she was not Sai Mosieff, but for the sake of the Koren, she had to restore her balance. She could ask Anath, her Sophia, to administer a penance, but it was less than 2 years since Neferi's unexpected death, and she still was not entirely comfortable with her replacement. Something told her she must do this on her own. Perhaps she had seen an omen she had not recognized consciously. Ants were not likely on a ship, but several sorts of beetle might be.
"No, Seleucia," she said quietly. "A veil."
Seleucia's mouth tightened in disapproval, but she replaced the cap on its stand silently. In private, as now, she had license to free her tongue, yet she knew what could be spoken and what not. Tuon had only ever had to have her punished twice, and light's truth, she had regretted it as much as Seleucia. Wordlessly, her dresser produced a long, sheer veil, draping it over Tuon's head and securing it with a narrow band of golden braid set with rubies. Even more transparent than the Daco Vale's robes, the veil did not hide her face at all, but it hid what was most important. Laying a long, gold-embroidered blue cape on Tuon's shoulders, Seleucia stepped back and bowed deeply, the end of her golden braid touching the carpet. The kneeling Daco Vale bowed their faces to the deck. Privacy was about to end. Tuon left the cabin alone. In the second cabin stood six of her suldam, three to either side, with their charges kneeling in front of them on the wide, polished planks of the deck. The suldam straightened when they saw her, proud as the silver lightning in the red panels on their skirts. The gray-clad Domani knelt erect, full of their own pride. Except for poor Lydia, who crouched over her knees and tried to press her tear-stained face against the deck. Ianel, holding the red-haired Damani's leash, scowled down at her. Tuon sighed. Lydia had been responsible for her anger last night. No, she had caused it, but Tuon herself was responsible for her own emotions. She had commanded the Damani to read her fortune, and she should not have ordered her caned because she disliked what she heard. Bending, she cupped Lydia's chin, laying long, red-enameled fingernails against the Damani's freckled cheek, and drew her up to sit on her heels, which produced a wince and a fresh set of tears that Tuon carefully wiped away with her fingers as she pulled the Damani upright on her knees. "Lydia is a good Damani, Ianel," she said. "Paint her welts with tincture of sorfa, and give her lionheart for the pain until the welts are gone. And until they are gone, she is to have a sweet custard with every meal." "As the High Lady commands," Ianel replied formally, but she smiled slightly. All the Suldam were fond of Lydia, and she had not liked punishing the Damani. "If she gets fat, I will take her for runs, High Lady." Lydia twisted her head around to kiss Tuan's palm and murmured,
"Lydia's mistress is kind. Lydia will not get fat."
Making her way along the two lines, Tuan spoke a few words to each Suldam and petted each of the Damani. The six she had brought with her were her best, and they beamed at her with a fondness equal to hers for them. They had competed eagerly to be chosen. Plump, yellow-haired Dali and Dani, sisters who hardly needed a Suldam's direction. Charal, her hair as gray as her eyes, but still the most agile in her spinning. Sarah, with red ribbons in her tightly curled black hair, the strongest and proud as a Suldam. Tiny Mylan, shorter even than Tuan herself. Mylan was Tuan's special pride among the six. Many had thought it odd when Tuan tested for Suldam on reaching adulthood, though none could gainsay her then, except her mother, who had allowed it by remaining silent. Actually becoming a Suldam was unthinkable, of course, but she found as much enjoyment in training Damani as in training horses, and she was as good at one as the other. Mylan was the proof of that. The pale little Damani had been half dead with shock and fear, refusing to eat or drink, when Tuan bought her on the docks at Shon Kifar. The Der Suldam all had despaired, saying she would not live long. But now Mylan smiled up at Tuan and leaned forward to kiss her hand before she even reached to stroke the Damani's dark hair. Once skin and bones, she was becoming a trifle plump. Instead of rebuking her, Katrona, who held her leash, let a smile crease her usually stern black face and murmured that Mylan was a perfect Damani. It was true. No one would believe now that once she had called herself Aes Sedai. Before leaving, Tuan gave a few orders concerning the Damani's diet and exercise. The Suldam knew what to do, just like the other 12 in Tuan's entourage, or they would not have been in her service, but she believed no one should be allowed to own Damani unless they took an active interest. She knew the quirks of every one of hers as well as she knew her own face. In the outer cabin, the Death Watch guards, lining the walls in armor lacquered blood red and nearly black-green, stiffened at her entrance. That is, they stiffened if statues could be said to stiffen. Hard-faced men, they and 500 more like them, had been charged personally with Tuan's safety. Any or all would die to protect her. They would die if she did. Every man had volunteered, asked to be in her guard. Seeing the veil, grizzled Captain Massenge ordered only two to accompany her on deck, where 24 Ogier gardeners in the red and green made a line to either side of the doorway, great black-tasseled axes upright in front of them, and grim eyes watching for any danger even here. They would not die if she did, but they also had asked to be in her guard, and she would rest her life in any of those huge hands without a qualm. The ribbed sails on the Kidron's three tall masts were taut with the cold wind that drove the vessel toward the land that lay ahead, a dark shore near enough that she could make out hills and headlands. Men and women filled the deck, all of the blood on the vessel in their finest silks, ignoring the wind that whipped their cloaks as they ignored the barefoot men and women of the ship's crew who darted between them. Some of the nobles were much too ostentatious about ignoring the crew, as though they could run the ship while kneeling or bowing every two paces. Prepared for prostration, the blood made slight bows instead, one equal to another when they saw her veil. Uril, the sharp-nosed man everyone thought was her secretary, went to one knee. He was her secretary, of course, but also her hand, commanding her seekers. The Makura woman flung herself down prostrate and kissed the deck before a few quiet words from Ural made her get back to her feet, blushing and smoothing her pleated red skirts. Tuan had been uncertain about taking her into service back in Tanchico, but the woman had pleaded like a duck o' veil. She hated Aes Sedai in her bones for some reason, and despite the rewards already given for her extremely valuable information, she hoped to do them more injury. Bowing her head to the blood, Tuan climbed to the quarterdeck, followed by the two Death Watch guards. The wind made handling her cape difficult, and pressed her veil against her face one moment, then flailed it over her head the next. It did not matter. That she wore it was sufficient. Her personal banner, two golden lions harnessed to an ancient war cart, flew at the stern above the six helmsmen struggling to control the long tiller. The Raven and Roses would have been packed away as soon as the first crewman to see her veil could pass the word. Kidron's captain, a wide, weathered woman with white hair and the most incredible green eyes, bowed as Tuan's slipper touched the quarterdeck, then immediately returned her attention to her ship. Anath was standing by the railing in unrelieved black silk, outwardly undisturbed by the chill wind in spite of her lack of a cloak or cape. A slender woman, she would have been tall even for a man. Her charcoal-dark face was beautiful, but her large black eyes seemed to pierce like awls. Tuan's Sophia, her truth-speaker, named by the Empress, might she live forever, when Neferi died. A surprise, with Neferi's left hand trained and ready to replace her, but when the Empress spoke from the crystal throne, her word was law. You certainly were not supposed to be afraid of your Sophia, yet Tuan was, a little. Joining the woman, she gripped the railing, and had to loosen her hands before she broke a lacquered nail. That would have meant very bad luck. So, Anath said, the word like a nail driven into Tuan's skull. The tall woman frowned down at her, and contempt lay thick in her voice. You hide your face, in a way, and now you are just the High Lady Tuan, except that everyone still knows who you really are, even if they won't mention it. How long do you intend carrying on this farce? Anath's full lips sneered, and she made a curt dismissive gesture with one slim hand. I suppose this idiocy is over having the Damani caned. You are a fool to think your eyes are downcast by a little thing like that. What did she say to make you angry? No one seems to know, except that you threw a tantrum I am sorry to have missed. Tuan made her hands be still on the railing. They wanted to tremble. She forced her face to maintain a stern appearance. I will wear the veil until an omen tells me the time has come to remove it, Anath, she said, schooling her voice to calm. Only luck had kept anyone from overhearing Lydia's cryptic words. Everyone knew that Damani could foretell the future, and if any of the blood had heard, they would all have been chattering behind their hands about her fate. Anath laughed rudely and began telling her again what a fool she was, in greater detail this time, much greater detail. She did not bother to lower her voice. Captain Tehan was staring straight ahead, but her eyes were almost falling out of her lined face. Tuan listened attentively, though her cheeks grew hotter and hotter until she thought her veil might burst into flame. Many of the blood called their voices Sophia, but voices of the blood were Sojin, and knew they could be punished if their owners were displeased by what they said, even if they were called Sophia. A speaker of truth could not be commanded or coerced or punished in any way. A truth speaker was required to tell the stark truth whether or not you wanted to hear it, and to make sure that you heard. Those blood who called their voices Sophia thought that Alguin, the last man to sit on the crystal throne almost 1,000 years ago, had been insane because he let his Sophia live and continue in her post after she slapped his face before the entire court. They did not understand the traditions of her family any more than the goggle-eyed captain did. The Death Watch guards' expressions never altered behind the half-concealing cheek pieces of their helmets. They understood. Thank you, but I do not need a penance, she said politely, when Anath finally ceased her harangue. Once, after she cursed Neferi for dying by something as stupid as a fall down stairs, she had asked her new Sophia to perform that service for her. Cursing the dead was enough to make you sigh more sief for months. The woman had been almost tender about it, in an odd fashion, though she left her weeping for days, unable to don even a shift. That was not why she refused the offer, though. A penance must be severe, or it was useless in redressing balance. No, she would not take the easier way because she had made her decision. And, she had to admit, because she wanted to resist her Sophia's advice, wanted not to listen to her at all. As Seleucia said, she always had been headstrong. Refusing to listen to your truth-speaker was abominable. Perhaps she should accept, after all, to redress that balance. Three long gray porpoises rose beside the ship and sounded. Three, and they did not rise again. Hold to your chosen course. When we are ashore, she said, the High Lady Suroth must be commended. Hold to your chosen course. And her ambition must be looked into. She has done more with the Forerunners than the Empress, may she live forever, dreamed of. But success on such a scale often breeds ambitions to match. Peeved at the change of subject, Anath drew herself up, lips compressing. Her eyes glittered. I'm sure Suroth has only the best intentions of the Empire for ambition, she said curtly. Tuon nodded. She herself was not sure at all. That sort of sureness could lead to the Tower of the Ravens, even for her, perhaps especially for her. I must find a way to make contact with the Dragon Reborn as soon as possible. He must kneel before the Crystal Throne before Tarmon Gaiden, or all is lost. The prophecies of the dragon said so, clearly. Anath's mood changed in a flash. Smiling, she laid a hand on Tuon's shoulder almost possessively. That was going too far, but she was Sophia, and the feel of ownership might have been only in Tuon's mind. You must be careful, Anath purred. You must not let him learn how dangerous you are to him until it is too late for him to escape. She had more advice, but Tuon let it wash over her. She listened enough to hear, yet it was nothing she had not heard 100 times before. Ahead of the ship she could make out the mouth of a great harbor, Ebudar, from where the Koren would spread, as it was spreading from Tan Chico. The thought gave her a thrill of pleasure, of accomplishment. Behind her veil she was merely the High Lady Tuon, of no higher rank than many others of the blood. But in her heart, always, she was Tuon Athaem Cora Paindrag, daughter of the 9 moons, and she had come to reclaim what had been stolen from her ancestor.